have a mainframe, statewide mainframe system.
Today is March 23rd, 2017, and welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today we will be hearing, public hearing on SB 5536, Secretary of State. Before we get started, anything, staff?
Not specifically, Mr. Co-Chair. The agency is scheduled to complete their presentation to you today, and we also have public testimony scheduled. They have a lot of material to go through today, so we're asking anyone who wants to testify to sign up now so we have some idea of how much time needs to be set aside for that purpose. Looks like we only have one person now. Okay. So, thank you.
So I believe today we are going to be finishing up with the presentations from the archives and excuse me, and then we're going to the elections division. So Ms. Heckert.
As they're getting seated, Mr. Chair, a point of personal privilege. Mr. Secretary, not only is it a pleasure doing business with you, but your office delivered my blue books, which I thought was exceptional, above and beyond the call of duty. Thank you.
We aim to please.
Okay, good afternoon, Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I am the director of the Secretary of State's Archives Division. And thank you for this opportunity to continue with our budget presentation. We'll just finish up on this slide, which is our KPM number one. I think we left off with, we now have over 10 million electronic records and growing in our Oregon Records Management solution. And in addition, we are scheduled to destroy close to 300,000 of those electronic records that have met their scheduled retention period, meaning for the first time we can say that we destroyed electronic records in a systematic and routine manner. We also have over 40,000 records from the archives holdings in our web drawer, which is the freely accessible web portal. So this, again, represents the culture shift that we are experiencing in reference by making the records of government more easily accessible and transparent.
Mr. Clearly, Chair. Oh, I'm sorry. I looked at the wrong chair. this is an old one, and we've talked about it previously. The overlap between your records retention and the libraries. And if you could comment on that briefly for our new colleagues, and also I would be interested to know if there has been any streamlining so you're not both archiving the same stuff. And I believe that theirs is a little more eclectic in its subject matter and perhaps more voluminous. I don't know what all they're saving. Annual reports from, you know, Oregon headquartered companies. I don't know what they're saving, but could you comment on that?
Sure. Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, what we have are the original records of Oregon government, and that's what we are responsible for. The state library collects the publications, so that actually the records that have been published, commercially published, of Oregon agencies, and that's what their holdings are. Ours are the official copy of the public record, the historical record. There's our circulating copy of only the publications that an agency may produce. So there is a split on that.
One follow-up. How, as you're getting ready to destroy records, do you make the value judgment that X record has some legitimacy to not be destroyed, even though the time has told on it, but that it adds to our overall knowledge of our state and our processes? Does that responsibility rest with you, or is there a committee if you're in doubt, or how does that work?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, it's my staff. We form appraisal teams that basically look at the records that are being created by Oregon government. Our schedules are only valid for 5 years for the purpose of value of records can change, and we've seen that happen in the past. Either something that may have been considered historical in the past is no longer historical, or records that we considered that had a definitive retention period are now valued, have a significant value to them, so we do that. So that's why we review our schedules every 5 years to make sure we are keeping the historical records of the state of Oregon. So our staff is educationally trained and certified to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. The next slide. Social media has been one of our greatest assets in that we are able to showcase our holdings on a daily basis, creating more interest and access to public records. We've had a number of posts go viral, reaching 11,000 or more individuals in a day by featuring a different photo or record every day. We've opened up the archives to a whole new audience that has more than tripled during this biennium.
Mr. Chair.
What's on your hit parade? What would cause 11,000 people to look at an archive?
The one that comes to mind is, and it, co-chair Senator Johnson, is a photo from circa 1940 of a family hiking Silver Falls. Oh. It went viral. We've had other posts on a specific event. We've done a historic tour of Portland that went viral. We did a mystery case online, and it went viral. So it just... certain things click people's interest, so.
Cool.
Okay, so our goal is to increase access to public records, and most of our work is driven by demand for information, whether we're working with our agencies or our own holdings. We have done a variety of things, some of which are our annual open house for National Archives Month in October. It's taken on a new life by offering unique hands-on experiences such as a murder mystery tour that allowed visitors to solve a murder using the records in our holding. And we also did one featuring the rich history of Oregon's microbrew industry. We also conduct quarterly trainings for state and local government employees on public records management. And the archives, we are working with on a curriculum for schools and the public and on how government works using primary resources.
Ms. Hecker, I think you went by, or did I miss it, slide 55.
Oh, that's our social media?
Yes.
Yes, so we post a record of the day or a document of the day. That's the ones that go viral that we were talking about. We have tripled our followers on social media in the past biennium, so we use it. It has become like our number one outreach tool.
Okay, you have a lot of Facebook followers?
Yes, we do. We're hoping to hit 7,000 this month.
Okay. You're tweeting.
We tweet. we
okay.
We love social media. So many of you may know about the constitutional challenge and our efforts to get the original Oregon Constitution restored and purchased, and a display case that will allow us to safely display the Constitution. The Constitution is the people's document, and it should be displayed on a regular basis. We wanted to give the people of Oregon, including the school children, the opportunity to preserve and regularly display Oregon's original Constitution. We have invigorated the drive, thanks to the Secretary of State, and have a great new crowdfunding website, which you see here, and it's been up for a month, and we've raised an additional $5,000.
Representative?
I'm sorry, I'm certain that you just said that you wanted to restore and purchase the Constitution, and I believe you meant you want to restore and preserve the Constitution.
Yes, yes.
He did say purchase.
co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, we need to purchase a display case.
Very good. So, well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted you to know I was listening.
What's the total cost of the display case?
Co-chair Senator Johnson, the display case is between $40,000 and $50,000.
And you've raised 10 right now?
We're at 11 right now. We just received another check, so it's going to cost approximately $15,000 to $20,000 to do the restoration work, and then another $40,000 to $50,000 to get a case. And if we raise enough money, we'd like to purchase a case for the Capitol as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, in order to meet our goals of increased access to public records, each unit has identified where it needs to focus its work so we can be successful. In records management, that focuses helping to keep government accountable and transparent. Our Oregon Records Management solution continues to grow and continues to prove that standalone systems for every government agency to manage their electronic records does not make sense financially or administratively, but having one system that all levels of government can access that is affordable and easy to use does. In reference, our focus is on engaging more Oregonians in their government, and this effort has allowed us to begin a fundamental shift in archives reference services, where traditionally the reference archivist had an internal scholarly focus, to now where we want to actively engage all Oregonians in what we do, the records that we have, and how they can be used. We are actively working with Willamette University and Western Oregon University to draw in student interns, where students can work on a project meaningful to them and produce a product that not only earns them college credit, but provides us with more insightful knowledge and better access to our records. We have a thriving volunteer program. Our volunteers have given us over 1,400 hours of service. And on a side note, our oldest and longest tenured volunteer turns 90 in May, and she still comes into the archives twice a week to enter information into the early Oregonian database. Publications will focus on continuing to transition to the Oregon Administrative Rules database, which makes the process much more transparent, and the public will be able to track agency rulemaking in real time. And we get to our packages. Policy Package 109 is for Phase 3 of the Archives Shelving Project. This is the completed first floor, which was Phases 1 and 2. We've recently learned that commercial storage areas that agencies are using to store historical records prior to transferring them to us are quickly becoming unavailable as leases are not being renewed because the buildings are being repurposed for a more profitable use. This will result in a more rapid transfer of records to the state archives. If Package 109 is not approved, we anticipate running out of space right at the either end of the next biennium or early in the 2019-21 biennium. The second package we have is the Oregon Blue Book. The Blue Book has been printed continuously since 1911. Unfortunately, we've seen the number of Blue Books purchased steadily fall, due in large part to the success of the online version. So once again, we are victims of our own success. This year, we reduced our print run from 5,500 to 4,000, of which 2,500 are statutorily required to be freely distributed to schools, state agencies, cities, counties, legislators, and elected officials. This will leave us with 1,500 books to sell at $18 a piece. We've considered raising the price, but our market research indicates that we've reached the maximum price point. If we do not receive stable funding, we will look to reduce the free distribution, reduce the size and information contained in the Blue Book, and eventually we may have to consider not producing the print version, which we really don't want to do.
Right, yeah. Good
option. Okay, and the last package we have is just a position true-up for our State Record Center. There's two gentlemen that work out there full-time. Mm-hmm. One was classified lower than the other. They do the exact same work, except one has lead work responsibilities. They handle extremely confidential information in that they handle all the sealed vital records that we have and also corrections and institutional records, and the classification brought them to the same level. Our proposed legislation is Senate Bill 227, which modernizes the Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 183 as it relates to administrative rules, because we are now going to have a fully electronic system. The language in the statute just needs to be modernized. We also have Senate Bill 228, which, amongst other things, would require rule hearings and the use of an advisory committee by all state agencies and boards and commissions making rules. So in closing, the Archives Division continues to grow and evolve. Most people think of archives as dark, dusty warehouses of records that only a few privileged few can access. The Oregon State Archives couldn't be further from that thought. Preserving the records of government is very important and something we pride ourselves in doing. However, providing access to that information, making government transparent and holding them accountable is equally important. And I think we can also take pride in our role in making this happen. Thank you, and if you have any additional questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. You may have answered this, and I apologize. I've been sitting here looking at your website, which, by the way, is really done well.
Thank you.
I guess I need assurance that the Archives Division, and I know Senator Johnson raised this question yesterday, the Oregon Historical Society, State Library, is there communication, conversation? Is there a once-a-year meeting of the minds? Talk to me about how the three of you folks are working together.
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, we talk to each other on a regular basis, especially the Historical Society. Since their new director came on board, the relationship that at one time was very non-existent has grown, and it has become collaborative. We look at to make sure that we're not overlapping anything that we are doing. And it really works well. And we have a great working relationship. Last session, as far as the state library goes, last session there was a requirement that the state library, the state law library, and the state archives meet to communicate what we are doing, where our focus is, and that sort of thing. And we have had those meetings. So we are trying to work so that, again, there is no overlap in what we're doing.
Okay. And I know that's an elementary question, but in my mind, I just wanted to make sure that communication is occurring between key partners. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Ms. Co-Chair and members of the committee, as Stephen Trout with the elections comes up, I'd like to just mention that as I've assumed my responsibilities and I'm taking seriously the fact that I'm second in line, and if there was a serious problem that affected the Capitol, we would not be able to continue our business. And so one thing that we're looking at in the future, and we haven't put it in the current budget because of timing and so forth, is the possibility of having a generator at the Archives Division at their headquarters and making that a follow-up location so that we could conduct business even if there was a problem in the Capitol or we were to lose power. Okay, and that's going to cost some money, but we wanted to just let you know that we're looking at that in the future.
Okay, Mr. Secretary, could you please, for the record, state your name?
Sorry, I did it again. I'm not used to doing this. I'm Dennis Richardson, Secretary of State, and what I previously said, I really believe.
That sounds like a commercial.
I didn't know how else to put it. Anyway, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Trout, Elections Division Director in the Secretary of State's office. Great to be here with you this afternoon to talk about my team, the things that we do, and our budget request. We're the general fund part of the agency, but we also do receive county payments into other funds, and are currently using federal funds from the Help America Vote Act from 2002 to help to serve the voters of our state. We have 21 full-time employees, and we
Representative,
can you just go back one slide, please? Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So the federal funds, $5 million for the next biennium, is that just Help America Vote Act funds, or are there other federal funds in there?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Fahey, those are all Help America Vote Act funds.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're in charge of enforcing election rules, those in the Constitution and those in chapters 246 to 260, as well as those federal laws that apply, such as the Help America Vote Act, National Voter Registration Act, UOCAVA for Uniform Overseas Military Citizens, and those other federal laws that impact elections. Again, we work with our county partners to conduct the elections and handle all initiatives and referendum. As I'm sure you're aware, we process all campaign finance transactions and ensure that reporting and publication so that the public can see where the funds are coming from. We handle voter registration to include Oregon voter. We enforce election law violations and those statutes. Service committees and really are a service-oriented group to provide answers for those that are thinking about running for office, thinking about circulating an initiative, have questions about campaign finance or anything about the process of their government, so that we can help them have a better understanding, number one, how it works, number two, how they can be a part of that.
Before we move on, something kind of blazed by. Did we skip a slide? Is it? Can you go back one slide? Okay. Did we talk about this one?
So I went through it pretty quickly.
Okay.
So in the interest of time, just the federal laws and the Oregon statutes that apply. And I apologize. I know I've got my colleagues here behind us that we're trying to get in here today, but I appreciate you stopping me and making sure that we get you the information you need.
Yeah, because I'm kind of new and stuff, and I know that. You know, I appreciate you helping me in particular understand so I've never seen these acronyms before.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what they are.
Sure. So, and something I try not to do. So the Help America Vote Act was passed by Congress in 2002 after the 2000 election, provided $3.9 billion to the states throughout the country and made a lot of changes to election laws, put in some new protections, established new standards for voting systems to be tested to, really just kind of improved election administration throughout the country after the close election in 2000. National Voter Registration Act has been in place since 93, often known as Motor Voter, at the national level, that makes sure that voter registration is an opportunity to register when you transact business with DMV. Obviously, we've had a great partnership with DMV and been able to modernize that and really take more advantage of it and automate that and gain some efficiencies and really see an increase in the registered voters here in the state. And then the other one I mentioned is called UOCAVA. It has to do with military and overseas voters, making sure that they're going to receive their ballots, that they're mailed to them at least 45 days before the election to give them more time for those ballots to come back so that we can hopefully make sure that we're going to be able to count their ballots and try to reduce some of the barriers that those that are overseas would have in getting the ballot delivered back.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Cochair. So you said $3.5 billion in Help America Vote. How much of that has Oregon gotten over the years? And when? I mean, most recently, like our most recent grant?
So Mr. Cochair, Representative Fahey, I will have to go back and look. Most of that was awarded back in 2005.
Okay.
And we've been spending that down over time. It's what we use to fund the OCVR, which is our Oregon Centralized Voter Registration Database. That was one of the requirements of the Help America Vote Act, that there be one single unified source for all voter registration. Helps with transparency, accuracy, and security. And so we can get you that number, exactly what Oregon's share of that was. It was used, like I said, for OCVR. It was used to replace the old punch card voting machines. And so most of that's been expended and was early on. And we've used those monies and invested them well to try to continue to fund OCVR as long as we could and make sure that really OCVR is the heart and soul of elections, both for the state and the counties, that's in good operating order and that we can continue that as long as possible with this federal funding.
So was it one time in 2005, or did we get some money every few years, and now how did that work?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Fahey, most of it was up front. I think there were five different categories of funds that came in. Most of that was up front. And then there were some other grants over time, but I don't think we've received any new HAVA dollars in the last 7 or 8 years for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we have a lot of variables in elections, and those are challenges and budget drivers, as you'll see here on a slide. The number of elections has a significant impact on what we do. If there were a special election called, that has a big impact. The number of candidates we have, the number of measures that we have, the number of petitions that are circulated that we have to verify signatures on. So those are all variables that change from biennium to biennium that make it so that we don't have precise numbers as far as what our needs are going to be and what our expenses are going to be. Over time, we've been able to get pretty good at averaging that out, but some years are higher and some years are lower, and those are things that we can't control. Additionally, we get a varied number of complaints and investigations and lawsuits, and those are all things that we have to react to and respond to, that we can't really control what we're going to do. And so that's another variable that impacts our budget and is a challenge to actually administer the budget.
I got to ask, the lawsuits, I'm just learning this. This is pretty interesting to me, you know. The lawsuits, what do those lawsuits look like? I know the allegations, I'm assuming, and stuff, but in terms of dollars and stuff, how much is that hitting you in the budget?
So, Mr. Co-Chair, it really varies, and it depends on what the lawsuit is over. So if they're challenging us on a constitutional interpretation, then that's covered by our risk management that we pay through the Attorney General. Other challenges, you know, we'll have to pay directly to the Attorney General. There's others that come in, especially after a presidential election, where we'll have some things that we need investigated from activities in the highest volume election that we'll have to refer to the Attorney General and to be able to facilitate those actions.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, when I came in, I asked that question because I was told I'm now being sued in 7 lawsuits. And I, as attorney for 32 years, I never got sued personally, but now I got 7. And so I said, well, I'm the consumer. I'm the client. DOJ you're my attorneys. I want to know, what are we paying for this? How much are we into these lawsuits? One of them, we're into $250,000. It was a lawsuit that has gone all the way to been tried, gone to the Supreme Court, all the way back, remanded, and now it's going forward. And so we're looking at each of the lawsuits to try and see if they can be settled. And what, you know, once you're in litigation, I understand the process, and sometimes it just keeps going. And so we've looked at what we can do. I think we're now down to 5 lawsuits. 2 of them we were able to get resolved. But once, you know, once we're sued, the Secretary of State is named as one of the defendants on every lawsuit that comes in that involves the process.
Senator.
I apologize to make you repeat this. This is really important. I had to go out for just a second. What's the nature of the suits?
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee and Senator Johnson, they depend. Often they deal with the petition process, initiatives, whether or not the process went through smoothly, were the signatures accepted. You know, one of them deals with inactive voters. You can register to vote, but if you don't vote for, say, 5 years, you can become inactive. Or if you move and the ballots return to you, you're still registered, but now you're inactive. So if an inactive person signs a petition, then is that vote going to be counted as a signature, or is it going to be not counted? And it made the difference in a recent year as to whether or not a measure made it to the ballot or didn't because of inactive voters. And so we're looking at that, trying to ensure that we're not creating barriers to the rights of people who are registered voters to be able to sign and have their votes, their signatures counted. So they get kind of complicated. Department of Justice is doing a great job in keeping us informed. I realize we've only been here 2 months now, but we're learning a lot as to what the status is and what we can do to resolve things. And one of the questions I've asked is, if a citizen is suing the state, there's got to be a problem there. Now, so we don't automatically assume that they're the opponent. Let's find out why they're doing that, whether or not they've got a real beef, and, you know, something that ought to be addressed, and then deal with it in a very professional way. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, we continue to have these different variables, and so part of that is the Help America Vote Act that we've spent some time talking about here, and those funds continuing to be used up, and we expect those to be exhausted here in the next biennium.
Thank you, Mr. Goddard. So I'm just trying to get a handle on the numbers. So the previous side, you said $5 million in the next biennium we were planning to spend of federal funds. Does that mean there's $5 million left in Help America Vote, or is it some other number?
So, co-chairs, Representative Fahey, right now it's about $5.2
million. Okay.
Again, most of that's going for maintenance of OCVR, the voter registration database. We have to continue to upgrade hardware. It's on a rotation cycle, and so some of that's end of life, so we need to pay for some of that this year. And so that's all included in those Help America Vote Act funds.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Trout. My understanding of HAVA, the Help American Vote Act, is that a priority there was to help empower disadvantaged populations, whether it's people with disabilities, other disadvantaged populations, people that don't vote as often as the mainstream population. And so I'm reading your second point here, that we're taking all of the staff outside of our voter registration process that were paid for with HAVA dollars, and we're eliminating those positions and focusing the remaining money on the voter registration system. So what happens here in Oregon to our efforts to ensure that disadvantaged populations are encouraged to vote as the HAVA dollars, as I understand it, were originally intended?
Right. Co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, thanks for that question. It's we've spent a lot of time and resources to develop good tools for voters with disabilities. We pioneered the use of tablets here in Oregon for the use of voters with disabilities. The counties have really taken ownership of that and have voter assistance teams that will go out and go and take these tablets to the voters so that they can exercise that franchise and be able to have access to those systems. And so I think we did a lot of research, you know, 7 or 8 years ago to say, okay, those of you in the disabled community, what kind of tools are you using? What can we do that makes this most like your daily activities so that we can make voting as close to what you're, how you're performing and your other duties that are going on? So we have those tablets. We have those voter assistance teams that are engaged and going out and continuing that we really, those shouldn't be impacted at all by the depletion of those Help America Vote Act dollars.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, I'm just trying to understand, Mr. Trout, are you saying that we are delegating this outreach effort to the counties? That would seem to be the case if the positions that we had within the Elections Division have been eliminated.
So, co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, the positions that were eliminated, they did a number of different functions. As far as voting for our disabled assistants, you know, those tools, those have been administered by the counties with the tablets and the tools that we gave them that we provided to them to go out and reach out to these voters. That doesn't mean that we're not going to continue to reach out and try to find those voters that have needs. You know, we're trying to do that with all of our all of those that aren't coming to the polls. We want to break down any barriers that there are so that we can, you know, honestly say, you know, we've done everything we can to make sure that every Oregonian's had an opportunity to come and cast a ballot.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. And Mr. Trout, I appreciate your candor. Just one quick follow-up, because I'm just trying to understand here. We were spending money on positions within your department previously, and I presume that if we were spending money there, it was because you thought the tasks were worthwhile and important. Now we're not spending money on those tasks. What are we losing in your department by losing these positions?
Co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, I think it was a mistake to pay salaries out of one-time HAVA dollars. As I've come in and looked at that, recognizing that these funds are nearing depletion, that we have the heart and soul of elections of OCVR needing to be kept valid, you know, we needed to preserve every last dollar to be able to do that. That being said, I think as the customer service, you know, unit that we are, we're always trying to help any voter that we can, working with our county partners, working with other partners within the communities to try and get people engaged. And we've been able to spread some of those responsibilities to others. Frankly, a number of those responsibilities have fallen on me just because of my experience, especially with the federal laws and those requirements. And so I'm confident that there's not going to be a degradation of offerings of support and service to those that are needing them.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. So other than responsibilities dealing with helping make voting more accessible to people with disabilities, what other types of functions are these jobs performing now?
So co-chairs, Representative Fahey, some of these resources are evaluating the data that that you know comes in so that we can help to recognize, okay, who's voting when, how might we be able to better serve them. They were chairing task force for the military and overseas voters, and you know working with DMV to work on the Oregon Motor Voter. And so again, this is, you know, we eliminated two positions, and you know we've been able to reallocate those responsibilities, and I'm confident we can continue to serve the voters with what we have. Although, you know, you will see here later on that we are requesting one new compliance specialist that would be funded with general fund money instead of the one-time funds.
I'm just, follow up. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Just a little commentary, maybe not a question. Seems like if the grant funds have lasted 14 years, you know, it doesn't seem like there's too much of a conflict with using those funds to pay for salaries, since it's not a one-time grant that only lasts a year or something like that. But
interrupt just for a moment. Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, when I assumed this position and retained the services as our new director, Mr. Trout, I asked if he would look to see whether or not we had the capacity to accomplish the mission without continuing to spend one-time money on salaries. Because when you're paying salaries and you run out of money, then that's going to terminate. You know, you can't keep paying them out of one-time money. And so if we need to be buying upgraded software and hardware on a regular basis, and if we had the capacity to accomplish the missions of what was being done by those two positions, then it made sense to me that we gather the resources from other employees and accomplish those missions without continuing to spend one-time money on it. And Mr. Trout looked at it carefully, determined that we could accomplish what was being done by those two positions utilizing other personnel, and so that's why those two positions were terminated.
Representative Fahey.
Georgia. So you're going to spend $5 million in the next biennium on upgrading the technology associated with OCVR, is that?
So, co-chairs, Representative Fahey, the biennial cost just for maintenance and support of OCVR is $3.2 million. As I said, there's also the hardware that's coming due for a refresh here in the next biennium, and so that's a big chunk coming out of it. Before I came into this position, they had put out an RFI for a modernization or a new centralized voter registration database, and the price tag on those came back at the 3 to 5 million range, and so that's what helped to facilitate. It's like we need to save every last cent we can to make sure that we can go forward, whether we bring that in-house, whether we go out for an RFP, and frankly, a lot of the things that we've been, some of these services that we've been doing, we can build into that RFP or build it if we bring it in-house, OCVR to be able to provide better services for the voters and for the citizens to be able to track their ballots.
Thank you.
Representative Gomberg, one more. Just one question. So the position that we're limited, when I used to call the election division, I was always able to talk with a person. Does these positions that were eliminated, are those a part of that? When I call again from with my questions, will I be able to talk with a person to help me navigate through the system?
Mr. Co-Chair, absolutely. We pride ourselves on that, and you know, we're happy to help, and we know that, you know, it's a personal touch, and you have a real story and a real issue that we can help you with, and we take pride in being able to do that. Sometimes we get calls from people just because they know they'll talk to a real person. They're calling about some other agency that we really can't help them with, but they know that they can talk to a real person if they call us, and we might be able to help them to get to the right person. And so, absolutely, we're going to be there answering the phones to assist you and anyone else involved in the process to be able to figure out what you need to do so you can be a part of the system.
Okay, Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Trout, I'm just trying to make sure I understand here, because I think what I heard you say is that we don't want to take one-time money and use that to pay for staff who are designed to help the disabled community. So instead, we're going to use that one-time money to pay for our core voter registration system.
co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, I think that is what I'm saying, that was really the foundational requirement of the Help America Vote Act, was that centralized voter registration database that all of the counties rely on and that houses all of that. And to be able to make sure that we have a list of voters, that we can know who's voted and who hasn't, that we can know who to send ballots to. You know, this system was built in the early 2000s, and it's the technology is waning, and there's new voting systems that many of the counties are buying that are having a hard time talking to the old technology. We've got new tools that some of the counties have come on to sort their ballots and to provide efficiencies and transparency, that we need to make sure that our system will carry on forward into the future.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think I smell the answer to this question coming, but if we're using one-time money for our core voter registration system that requires $3 million a year to maintain, then the question is, where are we going to get the money when that one-time money runs out? And I think I know the answer to that question.
So, co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, I mean, we've been over the past few biennium coming and talking about this transition, and you'll see one of our packages, and we've been working with Mr. Bender for quite a while on transitioning many of these two into the general fund.
Right,
I just want to make sure that, you know, it's clear that we are not talking about reducing any services to the disabled. We have a great tool out there that the counties are able to vote on and exceeds the requirements of the federal law.
I think we probably need to move on because we got some other people here.
Thank you,
but,
Mr. Chairman.
But I do have one final question before we move on. Of the $5 million of the two positions that were cut, how much were they getting paid? We can do a rhetorical question.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So we'll move quickly through our performance measures here in the interest of time. Our campaign finance filings, we've been over 98% sufficient there, and so that's been again part of our customer service commitment to make sure that we're helping our customers meet those requirements. We have our customer satisfaction survey here where we've met or exceeded all of our targets, and are proud of the customer service that our team puts together.
Just really quick.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have to share with you, Mr. Secretary of State, these folks do an excellent job working with candidates, with the treasurers, you know, with those folks who are handling CNEs. One of the things I did is went out in the hall and made a call to our treasurer just to say, how are things going there? And I have to tell you, it was glowing. And so really, really appreciate it, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Marsh.
I know we don't have much time, but I think praise is, we can always make time for praise, right? I had a treasurer who was new to the job, and I'm pretty sure he had your office on speed dial, a specific buddy in your office to answer questions on a daily basis. And, you know, the folks up there, unfailingly polite and helpful and patient. And, it, you know, it makes a huge amount of difference when you're doing something at the grassroots level that you've never done before, to know that somebody, they may be rolling your eyes at you on the other end, but it's not coming out in the tone or the way that they treat you. So we
appreciate Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And I've seen them. They don't roll their eyes.
Okay. I wouldn't blame them if they did.
So we want to encourage voter participation while maximizing access and the integrity of the voter rolls. So, as you know, we've been talking about OCVR to make sure that we can continue to be accessible there and have a good tool that we can rely on, that's secure and that we can have confidence in. Our great partnership with Department of Motor Vehicles on Oregon Motor Voter has enabled more Oregonians than ever to receive a ballot. We had over 300,000 new registrations, and the great thing to me was that over 99,000 of those cast a ballot in the November election, which was just a great result. We want to continue to use technology and data analysis to really figure out what's going on and what voter behaviors are out there. That'll help us to be able to serve in better ways and to be able to recognize where the needs are. And then we want to take advantage of the online resources that are out there and that we can provide more and more information on the internet, especially relating to candidates and languages and different groups that that we can serve better through an internet internet tool to be able to provide voting materials in different languages, to be able to provide more customized voters pamphlets so that voters can have better information and be able to have more confidence in what they're doing. We want to improve our stakeholder relationships and reduce violations, and a lot of that's just through communication. And so we want to set up a roundtable that will go through and discuss changes in election law, challenges that they have, and be able to make sure that we have shared understanding and expectations about new laws or proposed laws, that we're working together to serve the voters and make sure that we're aware of any needs from any groups out in the state. And then we want to partner with groups that we have in the past and will in the future to get more voting materials out to the disabled voters. We've been able to have good documentation to send out different tools with our tablets so that we can make sure that we serve them the best way that we can.
Do you have a I don't want to just continue on because we have other people in, but the outreach that you're going to, do you have what is the plan for the outreach in order to draw more voters in?
So, Mr. Co-Chair, thank you. And I think for the first time that I'm aware of in the executive office, the Secretary's hired a citizen engagement and inclusion coordinator, and he's been out in meeting with different groups. Larry Morgan, I don't know if he's here behind me, but really going out not only to do outreach, but to find out, to gather information on what needs aren't being met out there. And I think that's an important role, and Larry's out there and helping us to find out what the needs are out there so we can make a plan to go out and serve them.
Okay, thank you.
So, and then finally, elections are in the news, and it seems like they're under attack in the public, and so we want to do the best that we can to help to educate the public on what's real, what the real processes are, so that they can have confidence in their election system, that the people that got elected actually got the most votes, and so we want to try to educate the public, show them what happens once a ballot comes into a county clerk's office, all of the steps and the signature verification and how it's opened and how secrecy is provided and how security is provided, how it's run through the scanners and how things are reported. And so we really want to be out there trying to do education, not only ourselves, but forge partnerships with different groups. We want them to have confidence in the process, and we want to be able to be as transparent as possible so that they can have confidence and know what they see is what they get. So we have a number of packages that I'll go through quickly here. The first one, package 104, is a system integration between our two main election technology tools, which is ORSTAR and OCVR. We've talked about OCVR quite a bit. ORSTAR is where you're going to be doing your campaign filing. It's where you're filing your voters' pamphlet statements, and so right now they're two parallel systems, and we want to bring them together so that we're not having to enter data into both systems. Sometimes there's efficiencies to be gained there, both for us and for the counties, as well as making sure that we minimize mistakes. There's not a different spelling of somebody's name if they do it in one system and the other. So that's the trying to get out of this siloed two separate silos into a more integrated system.
Is that going to be a locally maintained, or are you going to maintain a system at the Secretary of State level?
So, Mr. Co-Chair, both of those systems are housed and run by our team. So package 105 are some just truing up some positions. Two of them were downward reclassifications. Most of the impetus for this was just a change from paper to more technology within the division. In the last 10 years, obviously, we're doing a lot more online than we were 10 years ago, and so recognizing the need for more technology related classifications. Package 106 is a continuation of those Oregon Motor Voter payments to the counties. They had increases because of the number of ballots that they need to send, the transactions that are coming to their offices. And so in the last biennium's budget, there was a commitment made to fund this for the counties going forward. And so we're here asking for that to be continued. So package 107 goes to some discussions we had earlier with Representative Gomberg. This is to increase general fund support, again, as a transition from all of this Help America Vote Act to have an incremental transition into to the general fund, so that once the HAVA dollars are done, we don't come to you and say, boom, this is what we've been spending, and now we need all of this general fund to cover this. And so this has been going on for the past couple biennium, and we've worked with Mr. Bender on this as a transition, and so that's what package 107 is all about. 108 is for one new generally funded full-time employee to help with this data, more technical and data analysis, more recognizing and reacting to the needs that we recognize from our outreach and from our involvement in the different communities, to help with the increase in minority language materials, both that are online. And so we're excited to be able to move forward there, to be able to serve more people that may not have been fully served in the past.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You raise an interesting point. I'm sure you folks deal with it on a daily basis. How do we deal with those Oregonians who are very legal to vote but don't speak English? Now, naturally, we think of Latinos, but we have a lot of other ethnicities in this state. How do we manage that, and how do we ensure that those with very minority languages in Oregon have the opportunity to get the information they need?
So, co-chairs, that's a real challenge, and we have we want to get as many people to be able to understand the process, and we're really working on what tools that we can provide to help not just the Spanish speakers.
Right.
Currently we do serve them. You can register to vote on our online registration system in Spanish. We have voters pamphlet information that's translated into Spanish that you can access through our website. We want to be able to expand that. We testified on some bills here a couple of weeks ago to be able to increase that. So really it comes down to, also we've been reviewing the task force that we had last session on minority language, and they went through and identified the top five and the top 10 languages within the state, and so we're looking at how many of those can we start to serve. And
but here's my question, and please know it's not a pointed question. Mm-hmm. What do we do with the citizen from Western Samoa? What do we do with the citizen from, Angola, who doesn't speak English but is registered to vote, legally registered to vote? How do we help them understand how to do it? Or are they on their own to find a neighbor who can help them?
If I may, there's actually a few bills in the House Rules Committee right now about allowing access to voter registration in native languages and voting materials in native languages. So
I'll come visit.
We can talk.
Okay.
But
Senator?
One other possible resource is the patient advocate's office at OHSU. They are required to get informed medical consent in some remarkably narrow dialects and have a registry of translators that are idiomatic speakers. And that might be helpful to you. Informed medical consent. Yes. is not casual translation. And the woman that used to run that in the patient advocate's office is a woman named Barbara Glidewell, and I can get you her contact information.
Thank you. And co-chair, we do have, if you call into our office, we have a service that we can refer that does many languages, not just Spanish or Chinese or the main ones. But I'd have to get back to you on exactly the breadth of the languages that are spoken. But, you know, that's one way that we can serve them if they reach out to us. We're trying again through our engagement and inclusion coordinator to identify groups that we can work with to help to find out what their needs are and to be able to support them. And that's part of the, you know, that's part of the challenge, is knowing where they are and who they are, and then trying to figure out how we can best serve them.
Yeah, no, I can see where that'd be a challenge. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you, Representative.
So package 116. So at the direction of the legislature, we were able to implement a brand new election night reporting system that I'm sure you all interacted with here in May and November, that provided much better graphics and better information and more statistics and data. So this package comes in asking for the ongoing cost there. The original funding didn't have ongoing costs included in that. And so this package asks for the $83,000 for the biennium to cover those ongoing costs of that system.
Senator?
Generally, how participatory do you find all the counties? We have 33 counties with different, or 36 counties with different capabilities. Are they all able to feed information into your system?
So, Co-Chair Senator Johnson, yes, they were all able to successfully. They were excited by that, and most of them have been asking if they can use it for the upcoming May special district elections. And so, you know, there's always hesitancy at first. What's the extra work going to be to be able to upload this information to the state? But we've been able to make it really easy and work with the three voting system vendors to be able to take the information from their systems and upload that into ours to be able to display the results.
Cool.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Do you have a sense for the traffic on that website on election night? My only concern was sort of wondering whether that website was of interest to a relatively narrow group of people who might be sitting in this room and in this building and some journalists.
So, Co-Chairs, Representative Fahey, I'm going to have to defer on that one. Our IT director is going to come up here in a little while, and he may be able to know. I wasn't here for that, and honestly haven't had a chance to look at the web traffic. But if he doesn't know off the top of his head, not that I'm setting him up, then we'll get that back to you.
Thank you.
And then finally, excuse me. So package 119, again, are more ongoing costs for new things that have been implemented that weren't planned for in the past. So we're asking for $290,000 in general fund for the ongoing cost of Oregon Motor Voter. We anticipate that we'll have about 420,000 new transactions here in the coming biennium. And so the breakdown for those costs, about 10,000 for brochures for DMV to help explain the process and to answer questions there, about 70,000 for postage, 160,000 for the printing and envelopes. And then we anticipate about a 20% return rate on those mailers that we send out. And so that would be another 50,000 in return postage that would be covered.
Senator?
Two things about this. One of them is, I think that Motor Voter at this moment is not without its technical glitches. I'm aware of someone who helped his daughter buy a car and ended up with all of her voting materials, his voting materials going to her address. And so I think we've got some issues to work out. The other thing I would be interested in is keeping track of the aggregate costs of Motor Voter. I think it was sold in this building as having a de minimis fiscal, and we're now at $300,000 general fund, and the word ongoing has a sort of ominous ring to it. So I would be interested in your projections going forward of how much Motor Voter ultimately is going to cost.
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I appreciate that. And that's, you know, something that we're trying to come to you with data. because, you know, I can just tell you what I think is going to happen or who's going to move into the state. And so we're trying to do some analytics on the data to be able to get better projections of what's going to happen over the next biennia. Because after we get through, you know, a full cycle, then those costs should really taper down. But it really, at this point, we're getting those people that haven't had transactions with DMV in the last 5 or 6 years. And so once we get through a full DMV registration cycle, that those costs should taper down. And again, we don't know, and that's why I want to see the data to know kind of what those projections are for each of the next couple of biennia, so that we can come back to you with better numbers, so that we can not just be guessing at what the trends are, but actually have a better tighter estimate.
Cool.
Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher. So does this mean that if we don't approve this policy package, we won't be sending these letters out anymore about how to not register if you don't want to be registered, how to mask your information if you're a domestic violence victim?
So, Co-Chairs, Representative Fahey, I think the statute requires it to be done, and so that's why we're here asking for it.
Yeah.
All right. So... we've talked about our proposed legislation. Most of those, honestly, are cleanup bills that have had hearings. I'm happy to talk to any of you offline about any of those. And then finally, the our 15% reduction cuts. You know, voter's pamphlet will take care of the first 10 if we need to do that. If we wanted to look at, you know, moving a portion or all of the voter's pamphlet to an online version, and then to get to the 15% cuts, we'd have to eliminate more staff. So apologize for rushing through these.
Yeah, I don't understand that. I want to slow up. What do you mean distribution of the voter's pamphlet
as a reduction?
So co-chairs, what we're presenting is that we wouldn't provide a printed voter's pamphlet to everyone, and depending on the range of those cuts would be how much we would that we could cut that. And it's something that
why would that be the first place you'd go?
Right.
Co-chairs, I think that's it's something that isn't required for the election administration. It's definitely something we want to provide that information. It's information we could provide on the web. You know, I've got to have the voter registration database running. I've got to be able to process transactions, to verify signatures, to process voter registration forms. And so that's the, you know, it's a very important piece, but the election can go on without it if it had to be, because again, we could move this to the web.
That's kind of concerning me right now. There are quite a few Oregonians that don't have access to computers. We don't know who they are, and we do have people with certain disabilities that are visually inclined but may not be able to use voice. So to hear you say that this is one area that you are looking at cutting, it really bothers me. I think we need to take a real deep look into this, because I don't think that this is a starting place that we want to start off. So that's just my personal opinion at this point.
Thank you.
Representative?
Thank you, Chair. What do statutes require you to do in this regard?
So, co-chairs, Representative Marsh, you know, we're required to publish the voter's pamphlet and then deliver it to each household.
Okay. So, does that allow you to not print the pamphlet?
So, co-chairs, Representative Marsh, I think publish is, you know, we could look at what publish means, and again, we wouldn't recommend eliminating all of them, but because there are certain people that don't have internet access or computer access.
Yeah, follow up. How would you choose among them?
That's the challenge. I think it would be, you know, we would have to, you know, communicate with them and have them opt in to say, I would like a printed version instead of having a digital version.
That would be interesting. Representative Gomper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
I'm trying to understand the logistics here. If I'm not mistaken, the voter's pamphlet goes to every address. So that means if I have two P.O. boxes and a home delivery, I'm going to get three copies. And I think that that mailing to identified addresses is more expensive than bulk distribution is. But on the other hand, if you limit the addresses, you save on some printing costs. What's the trade-off there? I'm sure you've done that analysis.
So, Co-Chair, Representative Gomberg, yes, we've done that. And, you know, when I first, you know, we've looked at that for a long time, and it's much more cost effective to deliver to each address rather than to have to print to mail to a specific address and to be able to differentiate between those. So that research has been done.
Representative A.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Have you ever looked into an opt-out model rather than an opt-in model? I'm not sure an opt-in model would work if we're talking about households that don't have computers to begin with, but
no. And co-chairs, Representative Fahey, I think all of that's on all okay. of that can be on the board here on what the best way to do this is, because frankly nobody wants to do this and we don't want to do this, but that's we'll have to figure out a way if it gets to that.
Representative Amber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm cognizant of the time, but this is interesting and critical stuff. And everybody loves the voter's pamphlet. That's why we're asking so many questions. But I'm getting hung up on the second part of the sentence there, eliminating our ability to provide technical support for these critical applications. My computer never goes down at a good time. What are you going to do without technical support on election day when your system crashes?
Co-Chairs, Representative Gomberg, so these are technical people within the elections division, not in the information services division, that are going to keep the lights on and keep everything running. These are ones that will help to make sure that election understanding is built into the software and into the processing. For example, understanding what the requirements of campaign finance are and making sure that that's built into the software. And so it's not
we won't delay our election results for 3 days because the computer crashed.
Correct.
Thank you.
So thank you for the time. I'm happy to answer other questions. I know there's always a lot there, but I also know that my great team behind me's got some good things to tell you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, with that, we're going to all step out as well for a moment, and Deputy Leslie Cummings will come up forward and will discuss with Jeff Morgan and others the administrative aspect of the office.
Thank you, Ms. Secretary.
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, and members of the committee, my name is Leslie Cummings for the record, and I am the Deputy Secretary of State. I'm here to talk to you today about the Administrative Services Division, and with the limited time that we have, rather than invite all the rest of the team up to specifically address the details, I'd like to give you a summary of the division and then point you towards the balance of our slide deck that will have that detail. And then if you would like to invite us back to talk more detail and answer more questions later, we'd be happy to do so.
Thank you. I think that we are definitely want to hear all of your slide presentation, and don't worry about the time. We can reconvene on Monday so that everyone get a chance to shine.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Okay, so the Administrative Services Division consists of the Executive Office, the Information Services Division, the HR Division, and the Business Services Division. We currently have $3,543,366 in general fund, $18,827,312 in other funds. We have 65.89 FTEs. The executive office sets the direction with the help of the leadership team to establish strategic and operational goals for the agency. We ensure the environment has the right level of people, process, and technology to achieve the operations and projects for positive results. We continually work to implement improvements and efficiencies in serving Oregonians. We lead planning and provide oversight of work activities. We ensure statutory and constitutional functions. We serve on the State Land Board. We ensure We ensure the facilitation of communications both internally and externally. We manage government relations and build partnerships, and we provide strong leadership to ensure a culture of continuous learning. So with that, I would like to invite Chris Mullen, our Information Services Division CIO, up to talk about the technology pieces.
Thank you. And just for so I can straighten out the record, when I said so everyone can shine, I only meant that these reports are fantastic. You're doing a great job. So take that in the positive sense. There was no slight or anything like that. I want to make sure I get that straight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Mullen. I'm the Chief Information Officer with the Secretary of State. The Information Systems Division provides the four main areas of IT support for our agency. As administrators, we provide direction, strategic vision, intra and interstate collaboration, vendor management policy, and budget oversight. Our technical infrastructure teams provide security, web, testing, networking, database, service desk, and end-user support. And we build, probably also importantly, in-house customized public-facing applications, a lot of which you've heard so far from the business divisions, for our Oregon citizens to be able to access the services offered by those business divisions. Our primary goals are to continue to mature our security posture and provide consistent, efficient systems that protect citizen data and make it easy for Oregonians to interface with our agency's portfolio of services. This slide, the key takeaway from this bubble graph is to illustrate the different applications that we're managing across the agency. Typically, our IT people are housed with the business. We work very closely with the business to understand the needs of the people that are trying to access our services. So we're not just there to keep the lights on, keep the servers running. We're actually engaged with our businesses, who are therefore also engaged with the citizens, to make sure that the interfaces that we're providing to our systems are user-friendly and efficient. Package 101 addresses the need for position authority for four FTEs to continue to meet our agency and division goals, two of which are limited duration positions that we're asking for permanent authority for those positions. Two are new, the corporation lead systems analyst and the elections project manager positions are new. We're requesting those positions to be able to focus more on continuing security for those corporations and election systems, as well as monitoring vendor relationships and remediating security through the design of those applications. As I mentioned, we're also requesting two developers who are approved as limited duration last biennium, and we're looking for permanent position authority to address the volume and deadlines, as Mr. Trout was mentioning earlier, of those elections projects. This bar graph illustrates how our IT FTEs, which is in the light purple, are actually divided amongst the business unit FTEs, which are in the dark purple. The IT FTEs only show an increase of two FTEs because the two limited duration positions that I was referring to are considered part of our current operations. So if you're wondering about the discrepancy between this and the last graph, it's we're only counting the two quote-unquote new positions that we're looking at. This next slide is for our security enhancements packages, which is being submitted to continue to bolster the controls, alerts, and security oversight for our infrastructure and applications. These tools take the work that we're already doing and casts a wider net, providing better utilities for more in-depth analysis and forensics capabilities for our security. And I believe that's it for IT. If there are any other questions that I can answer.
No questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
At this point, I'll turn it over to Cheryl Miller, our HR director.
We got the whole team here today, don't we?
That's why I said, you know, we got time so everybody can say who's running the shop.
Intern there.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Manning and Co-Chair Smith and the members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Miller. I'm the Interim Human Resources Director with the Human Resources Division with the Secretary of State. So part of our role is, everybody thinks about HR as being all about compliance and discipline, and we do some of those things, unfortunately, hold people to standards, but we also pay people, and we get them into the system. We recruit. We want to hire the best talent that we can possibly bring into Secretary of State's office, and we want to retain them once we get them in. We manage performance. We help managers with their staff, complaint resolution, conflict resolution. We work with DOJ on lawsuits as it pertains to employees who bring actions against us. And then we are also business partners with our business. So we work with them on their strategic plans. We work with them on how they will meet their needs in the coming years in our future state, as well as what gaps we have in our current state as technology improves. What do we need to do to get people where they need to be successful? Our goals is that we need to be prepared for the significant loss of staff due to retirement. So over the course of the next 5 years, we have 45 staff in the Secretary of State's office who are eligible for retirement. And so to be able to start the recruitment process, looking at what it's going to look like for us in the future, is very important. We know that our employees' training and development is very important to them to be able to retain them, but it is also important to make sure that we're providing them with the skills they need to be successful as we bring on new technologies and new businesses. And that's my presentation.
You're not done.
I'm not done?
Yeah, you still get to go.
Darn. Okay, staff true-ups.
Sorry.
I'm the interim. Okay, staff true-ups. So in the executive office, we are looking to take the chief of staff, who is in the position, but the position has never been filled at the PEMD level. We are looking to increase it to the PEME, principal executive management E level. The chief of staff, this would increase that classification to more appropriately reflect what that person does. In the past, we've had an executive support specialist two. We want to change that to a public service representative too, because that position really is more the receptionist. It responds to questions to customers coming in. It greets everybody coming in to see the secretary and the executive staff. And then we also need to increase the budget director position to a PEMG to align with the duties and the classification responsibilities that that position has.
I'm curious, and forgive me for not remembering, but this secretary has only been there for 2 months.
Correct.
And you're already reclassing positions that have been there. I don't recall that there were previous asks about reclassing these. How significantly have you changed the job descriptions?
We have not changed the job descriptions for the most part, but the people who were previously in those positions were at these levels.
Okay, my question is, if they were previously at the lower levels, then why now, 2 months into a new secretary's tenure, are we raising the job descriptions?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, when you are putting people in a role, we have an obligation to make sure that they are appropriately classified and compensated. So in this case, while people may be sitting on a principal executive manager D position, the fact is that we're paying them at a higher rate because of the job that we expect them to do.
So they're working out of class now.
They
are. Ah, material fact.
Yes.
Okay.
And they were in the past.
Okay. Thank you. That eliminates the mystery.
Representative Marsh.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So where are the costs to these positions indicated?
So for these positions, the way that the state's system runs, there's a position inventory control system. We call it PICS. Most of these positions going from PEMD to an E crosses, the salary range crosses. So When you put these changes into the system, because there's a crossover, so from a PEMD, steps 1 through 10, at a PEME level, those might be steps 1 through 3, so there's the crossover in the salary range, and the system then will automatically make it a zero-sum gain.
They're paying them now at the higher level, and they're truing up the job description.
I follow? Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. And but is the 19,000 going to show on the next slide?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so this for the 19,000, again, we have more true-ups. So information systems, we are looking at the information system lead analyst going from a 7 to an 8. And that will cost, and that's because the IT positions are significantly at a higher rate than the rest of the compensation plan for other people.
Mr. Chair, I'm struggling with this. I'm struggling with why this got those previous slides got so out of control the last time. You're paying them out of class. There was no effort that I recall to true up the job descriptions with the payroll. And now you're looking at a whole bunch of other staff true-ups. Is this a new secretary coming in and seeing that your personnel is really not being managed very well at this point? I mean, this seems pretty out of whack to be truing all of these up when we've had an opportunity to have done that previously and it didn't happen.
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Morgan. I'm the director of the Business Service Division. Part of the previous administration direction when they learned this was to true up these positions and get them lined up with budget. So these packages were in the budget request that the previous administration submitted based on that direction.
Oh, that's helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Morgan, it may be helpful also to discuss in terms of the costs of the positions, whether the dollar amounts represent just the costs for the upcoming biennium or what the permanent finance costs would be.
Yeah.
Members of the committee, co-chairs, I'm not sure if I understand your question, Steve, in the sense of we know that for as far as the budget is concerned, the way the system in PICS budgets it for the next cycle, it shows us a no budget increase. The reality is, yes, these positions are being paid at a higher cost. So none of these are factored in a permanent financing package. These are things that we didn't have the budget to do, and we were directed to true those up by the previous administration. I'm not sure if I've answered your question right or not,
I'll
Steve.
Talk to you offline.
Thank you.
So if I can do a follow-up. So what I'm, you know, help me out. What I'm understanding is that the people that are already in these positions were operating at a step or we'll just say, for example, a step above. So the only thing this is going to do is to classify them in that step without a pay increase.
Correct.
Yes. Representative Marsh?
Just talking to myself.
Okay. Careful, I'll call on you.
Maybe what Mr. Bender's getting at is the roll-ups associated with these now that we're reclassing. And I'd sure like to know what those numbers are.
Okay. I'm happy to meet with you, Steve, and get further information
and
clarity on that.
Thank you, and I'll provide that to the committee.
Pass it out to the committee. Thank you.
So our vacancies over the last bit of time, we have, it's very hard in the state to recruit for information system specialist eights. Those are hard to come by and hard to keep because they can make a lot more money in other areas. But we were able to fill some positions. We filled that position in 2017. We've had a number of auditor positions, and we have been in interview after interview, filling our auditor positions. We are currently receiving applications for our audit division director position. The office specialist 2 and the program analyst 3 was filled, so we are on top of our vacancies trying to get those filled quickly.
Mr. Chair, is this the totality of your vacancies, or do you have other vacancies?
We do have some others that are, we're currently also recruiting for an HR director. And so we have some other just off positions, program rep positions, but these are the high level, high paying positions.
How many positions were unfilled from your predecessor?
I will have to look at that and get that for you.
Also, Senator Johnson, co-chairs and members of the committee, we just were sent the most recent quarterly vacancy report that we are in the process of updating right now. And there was a rush on that so that we could have that information. So we are working on the most recent vacancy report that we just got yesterday.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? Long-term vacancies, how long is long-term?
You know, I've only been there for a month, but some of these positions, I think, were put on hold towards the end of the last administration, waiting for the new administration to come on and make those hires. So I think some of those have been vacant as long as 5 months. Okay. Any other questions that I can answer for anybody? Thank you.
Okay. Before we get into the wee hours where we're going to run out of time, so what I would ask is that we had one person that wanted to provide testimony, public comment, but I would like to invite you back on Monday because of the time that we're in. We won't be able to give you a fair shake with your comment, and we still have a few more presentations from members of the Secretary of State's office. So I would ask that you, if you're still interested in this, Rob
Bovet.
Yeah.
Yes,
sir. If you are available on Monday, could you please come back? You know, we're out of time and the committee has other commitments and don't want to hold them up. And I certainly don't want to deprive the Secretary of State's staff out of their time. And we don't have a time to continue on, but we will reconvene on Monday. So if you're willing, we'd love to have your testimony at that time, sir.
And Mr. Co-Chair, I represent the county clerk. We're just supportive of the budget. And I have some comments in writing that are already put in. So if I can't be here on Monday, it's all in the record.
Okay, very good. So with that being said, Mr. Secretary and your staff, we are going to end for the day. So I get my committee members out to their particular committees, and we're going to adjourn, and we will reconvene on Monday. We're going to adjourn a subcommittee on Ways and Means, General Government, on SB 5536, and reconvene on Monday, 1500 hours, 3 o'clock for civilians, and we are adjourned. Civilians, and we are adjourned.